So in looking at issues of character, we have basically been kind of moving phrase by phrase through the qualifications of biblical eldership in Timothy and Titus. Those are obviously directed at leaders, but you can't escape the fact when you look at those qualifications how incredibly normal they are. They're just talking about basic issues of integrity and consistency in your profession of faith, things like not being double-tongued, which you think, well, everyone needs to be that way, not being greedy, not being a drunkard. So it's pretty obvious as you go through that, that these are basic fundamental issues of Christian character or the Christian life. So we talk about them in the context of qualifications for eldership, but then we also remind ourselves that the reason that they are qualification for eldership is because elders are just simply supposed to model what every Christian is aspiring to, what every Christian should want to be. As Paul says over and over again, you are to imitate or follow his example. Imitate him as he imitates Christ. And so in talking about leadership, in taking our focus to 1 Timothy chapter 3, we're really talking about every believer. This is what every man should want to be, because this is God's design for marriage. And so we come to 1 Timothy chapter 3 again, and looking at verse 2, we see that an overseer, that is an elder, must be the husband of one wife. And in Titus, it echoes that same thing. If any man is the husband of one wife. By the way, I can't remember if we talked about this at the very beginning, but these qualifications that are given in Titus and Timothy are directed at, in the book of Titus, directed at establishing elders, presbyteros is the Greek word. In Timothy, they're talking about overseers, episkopos, which is a synonym for, not a synonym, but I guess in terms of the offices, it's another way of looking at the same office. We don't have separate offices for episkopos and presbyteros. We don't have a separate office for overseers and elders. They're just looking at different aspects of the same office. And you know that partly because the qualifications in Timothy are nearly identical to the ones in Titus. Plus, Peter brings all of that terminology together in 1 Peter chapter 5, where he says, those of you who are elders need to exercise oversight. So he uses the words interchangeably in that sense. So we as a church believe that there are two offices within the church. There are elder, overseer, / pastors, all those terms used interchangeably. And then there are deacons who are alongside of them. So we're talking here about those who are in that office of elder and overseer and the mandate that they have, they be the husband of one wife. Now, with all that said, what is your understanding of that qualification? What does it mean when he says the husband of one wife?
You are devoted to your wife, or a one woman man.
Why do you say that?
Because Genesis. It's the natural order of God. You are not. The command of God is for a husband to leave with his wife, not other women at the same time. You are devoted to your wife as...
Matt, you just jumped right in the deep end. I was really asking you to wade into this a little bit. I was really thinking just contextually and grammatically. You used a phrase, a one-woman man, which is literally what the text says. Mias gynaikos andros. One is mias, gynaikos is wife, andros is obviously man. So when he's describing this in the text, he says that an elder overseer has to be a one woman, man. Now, people have interpreted this in different ways in different times. One potential interpretation is simply that Paul is forbidding anyone from serving as an elder who is a polygamist. Now, in our culture, polygamy has generally not been widely accepted. We know that the Mormons have attempted to establish both legally and illegally their practice of polygamy. They endorsed it very early in their existence, and then they tried to hide the fact that they endorsed it. Now they're coming back around, or branches of them are coming back around to try to justify it. But even outside of that small sort of portion of America, you know, the Christian tradition has largely moved against polygamy, but that's changing dramatically in our culture. There are open advocates now, and in some cases there are even laws that are being established for the normalization of polygamy. I didn't write this down, but I was trying to think of the law recently. Did anyone read about this in Massachusetts, where they established benefits, marital benefits, not just for same-sex partners now, but for multiple partners? Yeah, anyone read this? So now in this certain county or municipality of Massachusetts, they basically recognize in some way polygamous relationships. And so there's going to continue to be a push for this, like there have been for all the other sexual deviations that are out there. So certainly, I think at a minimum level, we would say that this certainly does preclude anyone who is a polygamist from engaging in church leadership. But there's not evidence that was a pronounced problem in the first century. It was practiced in places, but it wasn't something that would have necessarily been in this particular church of Ephesus or in Titus's situation, necessarily something that was a major issue. Did you have a question, Quentin?
On the lighter side, he could have been warning.
About?
One woman.
About one woman.
You'll be unhappy if you have more than one woman.
Well, you're anticipating my next point, which is the fact that polygamy normally refers to the marriage to multiple women, but there is sort of a serial polygamy where you may not necessarily be married to multiple women, but you marry multiple women over periods of time. Or you're just like Elon, you know, you just have all these women on the side, you don't marry any of them. I was thinking about this. I was watching some news article, reading some news article yesterday about one of his baby mamas, and you know, how she was selling her Tesla because he cut her child support by $60,000 a month, was it? I was like, yeah, woe is me. What hardship. But anyway, I was just like, I don't know how many of these women the fella has, and how many child support payments he has to make, and how many legal battles he has to go through. But I can assure you, it's just getting started. He has set himself up for a lifetime of misery by his sexual escapades. And I'm sure someone has warned him along the way. He probably doesn't see the full consequences of it at this stage of his life, but I have watched it over and over again. You have watched it over and over again. People who are serial adulterers or serial polygamists in this sense, they don't understand God's design, and they don't understand the headaches that they will propound upon themselves. And if you lived in a culture, or have If you've just studied cultures that are polygamous, you know that this is true, even in places that have long-standing rules of polygamy. I remember talking to Mark Ndino about this. His dad was a polygamist, like many Africans. He had multiple wives. Mark had grown up in a home with where his mom, I believe, if I remember correctly, was the first wife. And then there were second wives with other children. And it's inescapable, the relational turmoil that fosters in homes. It's inescapable. There are not happy relationships in those kinds of environments. And so we as Christians have got to be able to articulate that God hasn't designed us to divide our affections and our allegiances among multiple people like that. It's impossible for us to do so, given the mandates that we have to cherish our wife. We can't make our wife feel cherished if we have multiple wives. And the children are inevitably going to be played against one another. So maybe we could talk about that some other time. Polygamy is mildly on the rise, even in our own nation. And it only makes sense with the foundations that have been established by our court system that there is no foundation for any relationship anymore. There is no norm any longer to appeal to. They've thrown out any kind of Judeo-Christian standard. They've thrown out any kind of religious standard. And so it is completely up to individual choices now and self-identification. So when and if this does come to court challenge, I cannot imagine polygamy not succeeding in the current environment unless there are some major reversals in court decisions, which I think is a steep climb right now. So we probably will have to confront this in our culture, and this verse will certainly have to cover that at some point, but I don't think that was the primary purpose of the verse. Secondarily, the verse has been interpreted to mean that a man cannot serve as a leader in the church if he's divorced. A one-woman man, in other words, has been defined to mean someone who has only ever been married to one woman. I don't think that is an accurate interpretation of this phrase for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's language in the Greek that very clearly could have articulated this. If Paul wanted to make that point, he could have used a couple of different terms that are used in other places of the Scripture to talk about divorce, and he doesn't do that. So the absence of that terminology, and it's language that Paul himself employs, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he uses this terminology very clearly there. He had it, in other words, within his vocabulary, but he didn't do it here. So I assume that's because he's not talking about divorce. Not only that, the phrase itself is actually reversed. If you have your Bibles, you can look at 1 Timothy chapter 5. And Paul takes up the issue of of widows. And he says that a widow is to be honored, by which he means she's to be financially supported, if she is indeed a widow. And I'm trying to find the phrase here when he says down in verse 9, let a widow be enrolled if she's not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. And in that situation there, he uses the phrase mias andros gynikos. In other words, he just flips the words around, but it's the same phrase. And I don't think there he's talking about a woman who has who is, first of all, polyandrous, That is to say, he's not talking about a woman who practiced polyandry. That was almost and always has been almost always unheard of. I know that was a lot of always in there. But, you know, very rarely have you ever seen a culture practice polyandry. It's been an aberration in almost every time in culture. So he's not talking about that, and he's most likely not talking here about a divorced woman, since he's putting this in the context of a widow. He's most likely here talking in that context about a woman who, during the life of her husband, now he's dead, had been committed to him. She was committed to him as that one man. She was not known, in other words, as a flirt or as a woman with low morals. So when you come back to 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, when he's talking about a one-woman man, I don't think he's talking about a divorced man. I think he's talking about a man who is devoted to one wife. Another way to say that is, you can be a person who has never experienced divorce and yet not be known as a one-woman man. You can technically only have been married to one woman, but you could have given your heart to multiple women. I remember when I was first in ministry back in Columbia, South Carolina, coming to interview for my potential church position. And so I sat down with the committee, and there was kind of some chit-chat, and a little more chit-chat, and a little more chit-chat. And then finally, you know, I was like, well, I think we should probably get to the interview part. Do you have any questions for me? And they like, well, do you have any questions for us? And I was like, well, actually I do. So I started to rattle off all these questions that I had prepared, you know, zealous young seminary student. You know, I wanted them to give me the dichotomy of the Trinity, or, you know, I'm just joking. I can't do that. I know Chris is like, what in the world are you talking about? I wanted him to, you know, give me answers to philosophy of ministry questions, certain theological convictions, some history of the church and stuff like that. So I asked questions for, I don't know, an hour and a half. They were answering them to the best of their ability. And then finally I said, well, I mean, do y'all have any questions for me at all? They're like, yeah, we have one question for you. What do you believe about divorced deacons? And I was like, well, I gave him my little explanation. That was the only question they asked me in my interview, which should have been like, ding, 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 red flag. Something's going on here. Sure enough, you know, I accept the position. I go to the church. Within a month, this thing is raging in the church, that there's a man in the church that is a godly man that people want to be a deacon, and there's another deacon in the church that won't allow him on the deacon board. So I get embroiled in this thing right away. The irony of all that is that the guy who was on the elder board, who was trying to prevent this other very godly man from being a deacon, was a committed flirt. I mean, he just schmoozed and groped people all the time in the church. People were terrified of him. But he was holding on to the fact that he was he was qualified because he had never been divorced. This other fella who was in almost 70 years old and had been divorced back in his army days in his 20s, now had been married for almost 50 years to the same woman, raised godly kids. In fact, a sweet man. He gave me his theological library when he died, a guy named Dick Matthews, one of the sweetest funerals I ever did. But if you go into my library and anything I own that was written by Martin Lloyd-Jones or by John Calvin or by any of those guys that's on my bookshelf was given to me by Dick. I came out of seminary theologically rich but book poor, and had very slim shelves, but he filled them up really quick. He was a sweet guy, well qualified to be a deacon, but this other guy who was holding on to the fact that he had never been married was almost universally recognized to have eyes for other women in the church. So this issue, like, was front and center in the context of deaconhood. And I think it just illustrates what the problem that Paul's trying to address here is, that you want someone who in their marriage can set the example for other people to follow. It's how they are living out their life right now that you are interested in. Because the reality is, a lot of people are brought to, or who come to faith, I should say, later in their life, after lots of mistakes. And there are any number of people who have messy backgrounds, but once they come to know Christ, they're completely transformed. They're the model of godliness. And yet, you know, they have baggage, unfortunately, from their unbelieving days. Poor choices they made, sometimes poor choices they made in their relationships. And in some cases, it is actually their faithfulness to Christ that led to the dissolution of their first marriage. This is what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, that some people, out of obedience to Christ, have an unbelieving spouse that wants to leave. And what does Paul tell them to do? Let them go. You let them leave. You're called to peace. So it's actually their faithfulness that if you want to say contributed, or at least it was their faithfulness that was the catalyst for their unbelieving spouse wanting to leave, because they were faithfully living out the gospel. In most of those cases, the unbelieving spouse doesn't want to have their conscience burdened by having to be confronted with the godly lifestyle of their spouse. And so sometimes they depart. And those folks eventually, in most cases, remarry to a believing spouse and live a very godly marriage and life there on out. I have seen it more times than I could probably count this morning. And so I don't think Paul is trying to preclude those people from serving in some capacity within the church. He's talking about those people who in their current marriage have a demonstrated track record of faithfulness. And you can see that they're devoted to one wife. Now, I think the prudence and wisdom would tell you that in that situation, if you do have someone who has a divorce in their background, that you need time. You need time for them to establish a track record of faithfulness. And that's not a short period of time, unfortunately. Really, any marriage needs time. If you have a young 20-year-old who got married, and you know, they've only been married, I don't know, 10 years, now they're 30, let's say 32 years old or something like that, you start to see the evidences of faithfulness in their life at that point, but you still ought to proceed with a lot of caution because of their youthfulness and because of the relative young age of their family. Well, none of those dynamics necessarily change if the man is 52 but has only been married 10 years. That still is a relatively young marriage and may have only now started to hit the, if you will, the bumps in the road that happen in so many marriages, and you need time to see how they navigate those bumps. In other words, they're past the proverbial honeymoon period. They've started to get into some of the difficult choices of life, and they've got to learn how to navigate those together, and you got to see how that's demonstrated within their marriage. Not to mention, you know, the if you will, the newness of the marriage has worn off. So you want to know, can this man show his devotion to one wife beyond this period of time? So even though there is, you might say technically, nothing forbidding a divorced man from being remarried, it doesn't truncate the need for longevity in observing his marriage. So there still needs, in other words, needs to be some distance of time between the past divorce, whatever stretch of singleness might have existed, and if there's a remarriage, then some track record of that. So the upshot of all that is that in most cases, if you're going to have someone serving on your elder team who is divorced, you're probably looking at a 15-20-year separation period between their divorce and their service in practical terms. But it's not an automatic disqualification. The issue really is, have they established long-term faithfulness in their marriage? Y'all have any questions on that? All right, clear enough. So with all that then, we want to turn our focus then to what it means to be a one-woman man. And we're not talking about polygamy. We're not talking about divorce per se, even though obviously there's application there. But what does it mean to be wholly devoted to one woman? Well, there are some passages that give us some insight into that, particularly in the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verse 27. And who wants to read that for me? All right. Verse 27 through 30.
You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away.
So here Jesus is talking about issues of the heart. He's saying that God's command not to commit adultery, which, you know, is really a prohibition against violating the marriage covenant. He's saying that this prohibition is not limited only to physical adultery. It's really also touching on the issue of the heart. God's design, in other words, for marriage is that you would have eyes only for your wife. And he illustrates it very clearly here when he says you're not even to look on another woman with lustful intent. You're not to look on another woman with lustful intent. You're to do battle, in other words, with this issue in your own heart. And of course, we know there are other examples and other places in Scripture where you see men, whether it's Joseph, you know, fleeing the house of Potiphar, or Job saying that he wouldn't put a virgin before his eyes. We know that there are examples of this kind of commitment to sexual purity, of remaining pure in your heart. But Jesus punctuates it here for us that we have to maintain this. And to maintain that, we have to address the issues that are going on in our heart before they ever work themselves out practically in behavior that would violate the marriage covenant. So this precludes any kind of wandering eyes, obviously, and any kind of flirtatious activity, any kind of pornographic activity. This precludes all of that stuff, this verse. And so for us, when we want to have a one-woman man, we want someone who is committed to this. Someone who has learned how to do battle with this in their hearts, which to do battle, you know, with this in your heart is, it is in some ways a prototype of how to do battle with all sin, because the sexual impulses that God has given to us are strong. They're natural to us. God has given them to us to find their fulfillment within marriage, but to learn to do battle with this in your heart is to learn to do battle with sin in so many categories, because sexual temptation is so strong. I think C.S. Lewis is probably one of the most helpful guys on this when, you know, he talks about doing battle with sexual temptation. You almost have to step outside the battle and dissect the battle theologically when it's going on in your heart and mind. In other words, this is not purely a battle of the will. This isn't just you sort of gritting your teeth and determining that you're not going to do something. This is you recognizing that when you are falling into temptation, that you are actually in a battle of deception. Like, you have to understand that what is being flooding into your mind right now, no matter what the source of it is, if it's some video that you came across, if it's some person who is throwing herself into your pathway, or if it's just your own imagination, whatever it is, the source is, you are being assaulted with lies. You are being attempted to be made a fool of. You are presented with the option of being a naive fool or being a person of wisdom. And so the consequences that you're facing are just that. And so when you're in the midst of this kind of battle, you have to frame it up, let's say, in your mind if you're going to have success. You have to step, if you will, outside of the particular battles of your will or even your desires to the battle of your mind and the realization that at some level, the temptation for you is to not believe God, and it is to believe the enemy. And if you believe the enemy, then you are going to be a fool. This is the emphasis that is there in the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs primarily present the person giving in to sexual temptation as a fool. They're being made a fool of by themselves and by the person who is tempting them. And so you've got to learn to think about these things in that way, to the point that it becomes offensive to you. Not the act in and of itself, which is offensive, but what is offensive to you is that someone is trying to make a fool out of you. And that should offend you, because you believe that what you are being tempted to do is, in fact, incredibly foolish. And you don't want to be made a fool of by any woman, and you don't want to be made a fool of by Satan himself. These are the personalities who are assaulting you and coming against you. You don't want to be made a fool of by anybody, because you know that when you are made a fool of, they will, in due time, abandon you in your folly to taste the consequences of it. So you're subduing your heart, not just through the sheer grit of will, but through the lens of truth. The truth that Matt started to allude to earlier, which is God establishes His design for marriage in the garden, and the establishment was one man and one woman. And that was His pathway for blessing. He did that. He created the world. He created the garden. He created Adam and Eve. He placed them there together. And He declared, "This is very good. This design is perfect. This is the way that the world will flourish. This is the way that all the creatures on the earth will flourish when they are this way, when they are following His created order." And of course, we know later on Jesus endorses that whenever He's asked about a woman who had married and then had her husband die, and married, had her husband die, and married, had her husband die. People were using that hypothetical scenario to try to either capture Jesus in an error or to create a loophole for their own sexual immorality, their own desires, Jesus would have none of it. He wouldn't even, if you'll notice, he doesn't even engage them in their speculative question, which is great insight whenever you're dealing with skeptics and critics of Christianity. What does he do? He says, "You are mistaken, not understanding the Word of God, for in the beginning he created them male and female. And so therefore man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh." So he just points them back to God's original design and gives them that and leaves them on their way to sort through their own sort of deviations in their heart. But this is what he affirms. He affirms God's design for marriage. And this is the truth that you've got to preach to yourself over and over again whenever you are in any way tempted to have wondering eyes. You're preaching to yourself that this is not only rebellion against God's law, not only is it a violation, this is not only in the words of Matthew 5:27, not only is this a form of adultery, but this is just utter folly. I'm going to be revealed as a dupe by doing this. And so when you begin to frame it up that way, the offense of being deceived and duped becomes stronger than the desire for whatever momentary satisfaction you might be seeking in that relationship. I don't know if you've ever been duped or if you've ever been made a public fool of, but it is not a good feeling. Not a good feeling. Some of those events that took place in my life, particularly when I was a younger man, when people intentionally did things to publicly humiliate me, are still etched in my mind. I still lay in bed and think about them. How powerful it was to be made a public fool in some way. Actually, a couple cases, it's actually my own doing, I got to admit. I could tell those stories, but we'd be here for another hour. But still, that's a powerful, powerful force in your mind. The force to not want to be made to look like an idiot. And yet that's exactly what you're doing when you're engaging in this. So to channel our hearts in the right direction, we have to put it through the lens of God's Word. And God's Word tells us very clearly that we have to be committed, devoted to this one woman, because that is God's design. That's what he called us to be. Now, that's, if you want to say, that's one half of the equation, is understanding this aversion or this obstruction or whatever you want to call it, this avoidance of having a wandering heart and a wandering mind. The other half of the equation is finding your satisfaction within your marriage. If you are a married man, learning to find satisfaction in that. And that is a whole category of instruction that comes to us from various passages of Scripture, beginning obviously in Ephesians chapter 5. If you want to turn there with me. Ephesians 5, someone can read for me down in verse 23, I think it is. I'm thinking verse 25. Someone read verse 25 through verse 30.
Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. he who loves his wife loves himself. Is it 30?
All the way to 30, yeah.
For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body.
If you wanted to summarize this, God's design for you within marriage, you could probably do it with one word, which is love. It's love. I say that because the word love is repeated 5 times in those verses. You know which word is not said in those verses? Well, you're probably thinking, well, there's a lot of words that are not said in those verses. But one we often associate with our role, lead. He never actually says, lead your wife. Now, I know back in verse 23, he says the husband is the head of the wife, and that does have implications. But in his instruction that he gives directly to husbands, his primary focus is to tell them to love their wife. He doesn't even give them other important commands, although they are implied here throughout. He's not necessarily saying protect your wife, doesn't even directly say provide for your wife, though again, I think the implications are spelled out here. But the primary command, the explicit command, we should say, is that you love your wife. So this is the overarching responsibility of husbands, is to love. The chief verb that defines what we're supposed to be doing in our marriage. And he further expounds on that when he says, husbands, love your wives. How? In verse 25? As Christ loved the church and... So the primary attribute of this love is self-giving. It's the primary attribute of it. It is self-giving. When he commands you to love your wife, he's not necessarily talking about your romance as much as he's talking about your self-giving sacrifice. You're a lover of your wife to the extent that you learn to sacrifice yourself. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends, as Jesus says in John 15. So we are to aspire to the greatest, the highest kind of love, which is this self-sacrificial love. So this means a husband will give up and lay down his priorities. He will give up and lay down his self-interests. He will give up and lay down his rights. He will give up and lay down his life, if necessary, for the interest and the benefits of his wife. For me, that meant very practical things when I got married. First of all, I had to learn how to play tennis because my wife was a tennis player, never played tennis. And so I had to figure out how to play tennis and enjoy tennis. And it was not easy. The tennis was not easy, but the other hard part was that my primary instructor was my wife, who I was trying to beat, and I'm a very competitive person. I did eventually win at least one match against her. She was 9 months pregnant, but I did win, and I'm not letting her forget it. So I had to learn to love the things that she loved. And be interested in the things that she's interested in. I even watched The Sound of Music. Yeah, all the way through. I didn't make it the first 2 times. But the 3rd time, I got past the gazebo scene, which is the worst scene in that whole movie. And I started to realize, wait, there's actually a plot here. And I got very interested. I actually came to love musicals after that, but I had never watched a musical ever in my life. In fact, I was raised, my mom left us, I was raised by my dad with my 4 brothers. I grew up in a home with no women at all. So from tiny life, I never knew what it was to live under a roof with another woman. So getting married was, let's just say, culture shock in many ways for me, and I had a very patient wife. But I had to learn to put her interests ahead of my own. I had to learn to lay down whatever my, you know, sort of machoism might have driven me toward in terms of self-proclaimed manhood or whatever it was, and realized that loving is sacrificing. Loving is laying down myself. And it's an ongoing daily choice that you make to set aside your selfish pursuits and to prioritize the pursuit of your wife, meeting her desires above your desires, putting her goals above your goals, her plans above your plans, her interest above your interests. And when you do that, you set yourself on the surest pathway of satisfaction in marriage. And by setting yourself up with that kind of satisfaction, you set a safeguard in your heart, because you're on a pathway of blissful existence that makes any other relationship, way less desirable. I'm in that camp, of people that say, if my wife ever died, would you remarry? And I just think, man, I cannot imagine all the time it took me to figure this woman out. I don't know if I want to go back through that again. I've been in a 28-year pursuit of trying to understand and live with one woman. But it's a daily sort of pursuit and effort that you put in to master, if you will, that craft. But it's also a wonderful journey as you go all the way through. But it is built up over a lifetime. And you grow in it. And the more you grow, the higher the hedges are that are built around that home, and the less appeal or attraction any other woman ever could have for your heart. So there is, on the negative side, the sort of understanding how to do battle in your own heart and not wanting to be made look like a fool. And on the positive side, there's just deepening your satisfaction in the marriage that you have so that you grow in a one flesh relationship. You are what Paul talks about in a general way in Philippians chapter 2, when he talks about being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. There he's talking about the church. But what greater description could you ever have of someone who is moving deeper and deeper into a one flesh relationship with their wife? And yet Paul explains the way this oneness comes about by having the mind of Christ, doing nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility, counting others as more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not out for his own interest, but the interest of others. So this is the definition of how to build a happy home, how to build a fulfilling marriage relationship, one that you absolutely delight in, and one that becomes reciprocally a tremendous benefit. You are sacrificing, you're laying down yourself, you look out for the interest of others, but when you pour your heart out and life out like that to particularly a Christian wife, she, in the Spirit, is led to do the same. She begins to look up to you as her spiritual model. She sees your sacrifice. Maybe not an overnight transformation, but she watches and she sees the way that you sacrifice, and she wants to emulate that. And so what does she start to do? She begins to lay down her interests, and she begins to lay down her priorities, and she begins to lay down her interests so that she can serve your interest. And of course, you are mutually doing that out of love for your children as well. You're doing that in partnership with one another. So it becomes a reciprocal kind of love that is led out by your example. Now, I want to spend some time talking a little bit more about the practical outworking of this. Because that, in general, lays out the principle But the practical outworking of it was, what does a sacrificial love look like in the day-to-day choices and the day-to-day conflicts? And that's a very important thing for us to consider. So we're going to come back next week and kind of revisit this same subject to look at the issue of, well, let's just call it leadership within the home. What does love look like when at the same time you have responsibility? You're called to love, you're called to sacrifice, but you also have to give an account and an answer for the stewardship within your home. Because as Paul will go on to say in Timothy and Titus, that the husband or the elder is the one who is responsible for the overall management of his home. And so you and I have to take stock of that as well. So we're going to do that next week, and I don't know, possibly the week after. We'll see how far we can get next week. Any closing comments or questions? Yes.
What does this qualification say about the man who is never married? Is he not qualified?
No, I don't think it says that he's unqualified. I think Paul obviously was not married. He says so very clearly. And I don't think he would have put himself in the category of unqualified for spiritual leadership. But there's some, I think, legitimate debate about 1 Corinthians 7, whether Paul's saying he was never married or whether he was just unmarried at that particular time. Nevertheless, he was single. And he didn't look at his singleness as a disqualifying characteristic. So I don't think you can extend that to say that every elder must therefore be married. But if he is married, he has to be a one-woman man. Any other questions? All right, thank you for your time, and we'll see you, Lord willing, on Sunday.